Hi, I'm Justine. I am an alcoholic. Housekeeping. My sobriety date is March 16th, 1983. I have a sponsor. I use a sponsor, and I sponsor girls in the program. And I say that really more for me because I almost welled up when you were sharing again, you know, what this program is and what it did to me and what a second chance that I got. And I sometimes realize I really didn't deserve it, and yet I was given that unmerited gift. And when we read the promises, I remember my first few meetings where I sat there and cried because that's what I wanted. That was the answer to what I was seeking. And, you know, I guess probably best to start, really, I came from an alcoholic home. And although it doesn't, you know, there's such a debate, you know, whether the chicken or the hen, it doesn't really matter, other than it set the tone for what was acceptable, and it was chaos. So the only natural thing that I sought to do was people who drank. And whether it was hereditary or not, it was, in our family, alcoholism didn't run and galloped. And, you know, there's stories or stories untold because you knew they didn't end up very good. And I was from a family of, you know, my dad was one of 10, and 7 of them became lawyers. And the joke in the family was you either became one or you needed one, you know. And we were bribed as kids outright, you know, don't drink, drug, or smoke cigarettes till you're 21. And out of the 6 kids, none of us did it because the natural thing to do was they must be trying to hide something good from us. And sure enough, you know, I was a late bloomer in my family. And I started drinking at 16. And, you know, I think my story isn't so much the drunkalogue, but in how long, you know, a story can be or how short a story can be. I only drank 6 years. And in that 6 years, by the end, I had hit that black hole, as though I've just heard people share who have drank many more years than I did. But I found it, I felt it, and I thought, I had, if I had the courage, I would have killed myself. And I just wimped out. I couldn't do it. And it, my sobriety date is my birthday. And it falls just before St. Patrick's Day. And of course, I always get, why does an Irish person quit drinking the day before St. Patrick's Day? And the reality is that it was my 22nd birthday. And I didn't think I would live to see it. So I only was going to stop drinking for that weekend. And the miracle happened is that I was done, and I brought my big book, but I don't really need it because it's all right here. That first line, first paragraph in the agnostics, where I was searching for this answer. You know, for years you're kind of looking for, am I an alcoholic? Am I not an alcoholic? What constitutes an alcoholic? You know, the one that's sitting on the park bench. But in that first paragraph of the agnostics is, if when you honestly want to, and that was huge, if you honestly wanted to, quit drinking entirely, none of the, you know, maybes, that you found that once, and I'm going to have to paraphrase it now, that once you've had one drink, you honestly can't stop. And if this is the case, perhaps you're an alcoholic. And that one line, like, hit me after many family members had been in the program. They tried to get me in the program, and I fought them tooth and nail because I had that terminal uniqueness. Like, that's, you know, because I had dirt on them. You know, I wasn't arrested, but, you know, remember that. So that kept me sick for a long time until I hit that magical day. And it started... I mean, I tell people I was just a weird kid. I was drinking, you know, vanilla. You know, the vanilla was never in our house. My mother could never figure out what happened to the vanilla. You know, or the constant cough, because there was something about that, you know, NyQuil that was just that burn. I was like, wow, that was great. You know, so here I am in like first or second grade, and I'm sniffing those magic markers, eating the glue and coughing, you know, sipping. I mean, that's not normal, you know. And it wasn't really noticed because what my parents were dealing with police and that my brothers were, it was the late 60s, and they were dealing with forced busing, and they were dealing with Vietnam, hoping that the boys were just on that cusp where they could go, that couldn't go, and they just, you know, the war had ended, and the riots, and my brothers were doing psychedelic, you know, drugs, and one of my earliest memories was one of my brothers taking an axe to our grand piano, and he was hallucinating, and he thought that there was someone in the piano. Justine, who's sniffing glue and eating glue and sniffing the magic markers, tells the teacher that my brother, you know, smashed up the piano and that there was a boy in that piano. Well, you know who they thought? They called my parents in, and I found out that what happens in an alcoholic home does not leave an alcoholic home. You know, you don't share what goes on. My dad was running for the DA. And he was a lawyer, and he was not yet defending my brothers, but it was keeping all the ducks in a row. So God forbid if anyone knew what was really going on. So we had, you know, the family portrait and some of the campaign, and my grandfather was a judge in town that had died a few years before. So we had this pressure, like, we don't share what goes on here. And my brothers were getting out of control, and my sister had a few little episodes that, you know, brushed aside. And I was going to be the good one, you know. I was going to make it to 20, you know, that 21 to get my $1,000 and we're all set. But no, 16, I had, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll all at once. I'm like, this is it. Pink Floyd. Who knew? You know? And I was off and running. I mean, within weeks, that my attitude changed, my clothes changed, my friends changed. I'm like, I had arrived. And I was thinking, this is it. I also was able to keep up the gig for a while. I was pretty good in sports and very good as a student. And, you know, so I become the president of the speech club, and therefore it is my ticket to come and go off campus as much as I want. So who cares if I'm off getting stoned with the stoners and then off with the jocks, because I come home with a trophy and the school doesn't care as long as you make us look good. And I knew that story. So carry on. I went, I got a scholarship to a school in D.C., and I grew up in Massachusetts. So if you pick up my, that I have got SOBA in Massachusetts, and I have a higher power, I really, really work on that. But it was part of my, I have a sister Martha and a brother Mark, and they're not the sober ones, but, you know, the list goes on. And I do laugh because I come here, and I had a hard time understanding people here. And I shared that to someone, and they're like, we have no idea what you're talking about. But we know that somewhere out there that, you know, you call your sponsor and you stay sober. And that's probably the most important thing that that got across my first week here. But I didn't go down to D.C., and I went to a school, and part of the scholarship involved doing crew. And that worked great for about a day. And the problem was they had to go to practice at 5:30 in the morning, and I really hadn't finished drinking from the night before. So we had a little schedule conflict there, and that showed up right away. And especially when I'm in a Catholic school with the guilt that I grew up with, and the nuns are coming in, watching me come in from the night before, just shaking their heads. They knew exactly who I was because my mom had gone there and a couple sisters had gone there. And the truth of the matter is, I really didn't apply myself. I just got in. They offered me a scholarship, and I knew that the drinking age was still staying 18 here, and that's why I came, is that I didn't want to have to play around or come up with a good fake ID. I don't know if anyone can identify, but if you had a good fake ID, you didn't want to lose that. And the drinking age was they were playing with it. So I came to this area just basically for that reason. So most people were putting in their dorm rooms their books and, you know, moving in with their roommates. I set up my bar first, and I wanted it to look just right. And the problem was it couldn't keep the alcohol in it. And I said, you know, I was young when I came in, so I never got to drink the top shelf. I mean, we're talking Boone's Farm and, you know, a few Tanqueray and, you know, some pretty gut-wrenching, horrible stuff. But it did the job, and Heineken was like, he died and went to heaven if someone had Heineken. And, you know, so I never got that far, but I drank in quantity to get the job done as fast as I could. So, I mean, there are a few times where you just mix whatever you got and just drink it. And taste was not really what you were drinking for. It was the effect. And I, to this day, could swear I hate the taste of alcohol. But I loved what it did for me. And therefore, it was one of those things that, you know, I think about it, you know, if you have a food you don't like, you don't eat it. Well, that's not the case for me when it came to alcohol. I just, like, you know, do that old, just make it down, go down quick and make it go down often. And I still, you know, one of the things I identified with when someone shared at the podium was I gulp. I don't sip. I gulp. And I think I learned that just getting down as much as I could. Long story short is that I was failing school, and I'm sure that's not much of a surprise when you're spending much more time drinking than studying, and yet the name of the pub on campus was called the library, so for a while my parents really did think I was in the library, and it was true, until my sister came down. My sister was a senior, and I was a sophomore, and her graduation was coming up, and I had avoided going home for about a year. And the reason I avoided was my mom had kind of caught me in the act several times, and, you know, the word was, you know, out that she was trying to get my fake ID from me. So how I solved that was I just didn't go home. I mean, and I think about how arrogant and how righteous I was as a teenager, and, you know, we'll come to that afterwards. But my mom had Al-Anon by the time she had me. So they weren't throwing plates or anything. And I remember when my brothers were first, you know, starting up, and, oh, my God, she would panic and the screams and, you know, the crying. And by the time I came around, I swear to God, if the police came, she would just not even flinch and just say, there she is, just take her out, you know. So, I mean, the hard part about being the end of an alcoholic home is if there's recovery, then you're, the gig is up. And my dad came on campus to attend some ceremonies for my older sister. My mom was with him in the car. And she had diabetes very bad. And that year that I hadn't showed up, it was a dramatic difference. She had fallen, and she had the neuropathy, and her eyes were going from the insulin. And the disease had taken toll. And I remember, like, seeing her from the window, from my dorm window, thinking, like, that feeling that, wow, I should go up, like, my mom's not healthy, and yet that defiant little brat was like, no, not. So I started down the hallway. I was going to, you know, meander around the campus a different way, and, you know, you talk about God. My dad came away that just, I didn't think anyone even knew about, and met me smack on the stairwell coming down, and he just took one look at me and said, are you done yet? And for some reason, you know, I had said, yes, I'm done. But it wasn't because I was done. It was because when I saw him, one of those secrets that we swear we'll never tell had just happened to me. The weekend before, I had woken up in an alley between the Dubliner and the Irish Times. And I woke up in the morning, you know, you knew it was early morning, and it was a gentleman had walked by, and I kind of came to as he's coming through, and the look on his face, horror. I think he thought he just came up on a corpse, and the fact that I moved, that just horrible feeling. And I remember thinking, like, hey, what happened? I mean, I've got, like, an outfit on and no shoes, and the makeup is all smeared, and I was freezing because it was probably, like, November. I mean, not November. It was graduation, so it was early morning, but early, you know, spring. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, what happened? And this person came up, and I kind of backed off a little bit. And he said, do you need a ride? And I realized I had no money, I had no pocketbook, I had no story, I had no excuse. Like, what am I doing in an alley in the middle of D.C.? And so I said yes, but that feeling that this could be it. I mean, no one could ever see or hear from me again, and I had no choice. I can't, like, walk home. And so when I got in the car, the person said to me, where do you go to school? And I said, Trinity. And the look on disgust, he goes, you're a Trinity girl? And he goes, does your parents know where you are? And that again, you know, a week later, that's my dad saying, you done yet? And I got back to campus. I jumped in the shower and came out of the room, got the towel, you know, on the hair, and nobody even said a word except that they were heading, you know, to dinner and they said, you want to come? And as soon as I realized I got away with it, we're talking about step two now, the insanity. I'm like, yes, yes, you know, that the thinking, maybe it's just I didn't eat enough. Maybe, you know, I should have gone home with someone. Maybe if I only had had two drinks instead of God knows how many. And that thinking came over, and I knew I got away with it, and the mind started justifying my behavior. Fast forward that entire week, I was so conscientious when people said, you know, do you want a beer? And the very next day, after swearing off it, yep, I'm at the rat again. I go for have one. I'm closing the place. And then it's all the events for graduation. I'm like failing class. My sister is graduating with honors, and I have this thing that makes me think I should be celebrating. Celebrating what? I've accomplished nothing. So every night that night I had gotten drunk, and now I'm meeting my dad on the stairwell. And I just, the gig was up. So some people, that took years. That entire week to me felt like 10 years because I just couldn't stop. I just couldn't stop drinking. And I was a mess. I was probably about 40 pounds lighter than I am now. I was skin. I was just, my hair was like frazzled. It wasn't shiny. It wasn't healthy. And here I was. I arrived there 2 years ago on an athletic scholarship. And I was far from healthy, and far from doing anything positive in my life. Long story short, I go home to Massachusetts. And unfortunately, I'm thinking, did you get that feeling that once you said you were an alcoholic, you're like, the eyes are on you? So I'm thinking, what did I do? I ruined my life. I'd stuffed up. So now I'm under the gun. Now they expect, you know, you're going to go to AA meetings. And my brother was very involved with a men's big book step study, and affectionately called the Thumpers. And I was told that I would be getting a ride to the women's big book step study and that I was to find my own ride home. And that's where the Al-Anon had progressed from the last time I was home. The gig is up. We've got you here. You've got two choices. And in our book, it talks about that on page, you know, on the end of 25. Two choices. Continue to the bitter end or accept spiritual help. And if there was another way out, I would have fought it. But I went to that meeting, and I knew when that car pulled away that there was no car going to come back for me. So I asked someone for a ride home. And when I was in that meeting, a girl got up and shared. Actually, it was around the table. It was a step study. And I knew this girl because I drank with this girl. And the reason she was my friend is her father owned a liquor store. I don't know about you, but, you know, I was a conniver. People I hung with drank like me or could do something for me. And being a friend with a girl whose father owned a liquor store, she was a good friend to have while you're drinking. What I didn't want is her story while she was sober, because she was telling my story. Most of the events that she was sharing, I was with her. Only I knew I had taken it to the next step. And here she had gotten off, and I'm 22. She got sober at 19. And I'm thinking, okay, there goes my excuse. I'm too young. There goes my excuse because I carried on. And I asked her for a ride home. And she was so good. It was like, you know, you knew that God was working through people, because she didn't judge me. She didn't say, good to see you. We're saving the seed. I know your brother. None of this. It was just, she shared her story with me, and it kept me coming to the next meeting. I remember not going to any other meetings in between and having that emotional up and down and feeling that peace once I got back into that meeting. So there was something in that room that I wanted. And it was the light in people's eyes. It was the honesty. It was the gig was up. And it was like they knew what was in my heart, even though I was incapable of sharing. And that's, I do believe, when they, the term, they love you before you can love yourself. And I hated myself. And I remember what it felt like to be in that shower, you know, after being in the alley, trying to scrub clean. You know, like trying to clean myself from the outside, but the inside was just, if you knew, I was like a broken mirror, and that any minute all the pieces were just going to come crumbling. And yet for some reason in that meeting, I felt peace. Having said that, as soon as I got grilled at home from my brother, like, did you meet anyone? No. Did you like it? No. Did you happen to see that person in the leather jacket with the tattoo? Mm-hmm. She's going to be your sponsor if you don't find one. And I'm like, hmm. Okay, so I went back the next week and asked the woman who I knew, would you be my sponsor? I said half-heartedly, because I was hoping she would say no, that she was too busy, that, you know, whatever, but I knew I had to at least say it, and I knew that I really was only half meaning it, but I did want what she had, and she said, yes, I will be your sponsor if, and there was an if you're serious, if you're done, and if you listen more than you talk, and if I can teach you the steps, then you will be helping me in my sobriety. And I remember that, like, she's putting conditions on this. I thought this, you know, and then I had been in Al-Anon and in a family where I knew enough of the trigger words, like, I thought were, you know, these were all suggestions. And she said, you know, if you want to be a smartass, there's the door. You know, I don't have time for that. And I kind of got that feeling right off the bat, and it's what worked for me. So if I say anything that offends anyone, this is my experience. And I have to say that I tend to sponsor that way myself. You know, there's the door. If you don't really want it, you may not be done. And for some reason, I was done in a short period of time, but I also had that arrogance, like I'm going to push your buttons, and then it's like, I'm not going to waste my time. If you're not done, then, you know, go do some experimenting. And it says that, again, in the literature. And I've often said that. You know, my job, or her job, and she made that very clear, was not to get me sober, but to show me how she got sober. And I got pretty humbled. I listened to her, and I remember she made me read the big book. She made me study the big book. She made me outline and look up words I didn't know. And she basically said, shut up. You know, you share when you have some understanding of what these words mean, and let other people show you. And there was a transformation. When you talk about the fourth dimension, there was a transformation in my personality. I didn't have a halo. If nothing more, I didn't have the yeah buts. I also went to other meetings, too, and I do suggest that. And I was taught, in Massachusetts, there's a lot of speaker meetings, and there's also a lot of step meetings. And at that time, in the 80s, it was, what meeting do you belong to, where's your step meeting, and do you attend Big Book? So if you were now, you were often, you know, kind of asked where your roots are, you know. And so I identified with the Women's Big Book, and we kind of traveled and did other step meetings. And it was interesting because I look back now, and I think a very unique setting. It was, although Big Book, they explained to me that the 12 and 12 meetings were written years after as a help to supplement the Big Book. They were not different literature, and they were not opposing, but possibly a way that you could help understand it. So it really did help me understand the Big Book better. And so that's what was done. I traveled in a pack, and through osmosis, you know, I started to, I remember the first time I laughed, like really laughed, not a fake laugh, but, you know, something was really funny, and it just, that trigger of a human emotion. And I struggled with emotions. I didn't know how to express them. You know, the Irish, you know, family, anybody who was angry got thrown into the wall. You know, it's like I found out that's not acceptable in AA, and that there were certain feelings that needed to learn to be expressed and learn how to appropriately act like an adult. I also went to a meeting with a lot of old-timers, and it was the men, the old-time men, who helped me. And I remember one time sitting and had my feet up on the chair in front of me, and one of the old men knocked my feet off and said, you know, if you want to be treated like a lady, sit like one. And eventually I said something, and he said, you want to be treated like a lady, talk like one. You know. So, I mean, there were a combination of a lot of people who were shaping and forming me, but it was in the halls of AA. Having said that, my parents had tried to do a nice job, so they really had tried to teach me how to be a lady. They did the above and beyond, but I couldn't learn from them. I learned from the people in the halls. And that was it. One of the hardest parts for me was that woman who saved my life, who was a couple years, she was actually a grade younger than me in high school, and she went out and drank again and disappeared, and that devastated me, but it probably taught me one of the most important lessons in AA is that I had her on a pedestal, and I had done my third step with her, and I knew what it felt like to hold her hands and ask God to remove the bondage of self. And I knew from her that my job was to write my will with his and that I would be used of service. And I couldn't for the life of me figure out if this woman did that for me, why would she go back out drinking? I thought we had the answer. And I found out from that experience that our program really is a daily reprieve, you know, and that if we can learn it, we can memorize it, we can spout it out, we can help others, but sometimes if we forget to live it, then we're only a day away from a drink ourselves. That was the most important thing that I was able to build my recovery on, because I saw how fragile, how quick that happened, and it scared me. My mom died unexpectedly within a few months. And I had not built up a support system. That was another thing that I had learned. She was my support in the small group of people. We kind of hung as a pack. And life had happened, and all of a sudden my pack wasn't as tight. And when my mom died, it was that the woman who had the leather vest on with the tattoo that was, you know, serving, you know, tea and demi-tasse spoons and I looked at her, and she had the light, you know, and I was like, I didn't notice that before. So other people did for me what I couldn't do for myself, and I have to equate that to my brother's support system. They came to the house, and they did the after, and they showed up in motorcycles, and it was called the fifth chapter. And they had, but they're the ones who saved me at that point, because I did not have enough recovery and enough tools to know how to deal with the guilt. I had a living amends with my mom, but I never had said to her. And they loved me through. You know, they loved me through. I had done a half attempt at an I'm sorry, and they're the ones who showed me that my behavior had changed in such a way that she would have been proud of me. And although I believed that they believed, it took me a while to understand that although I had spent a lot of time doing my fourth and fifth, that some of those characteristics, those personality traits, it was in six when I really saw myself in action. And even though I humbly asked God, that some of it was still in action and that he hadn't removed everything yet. And that's where I was when my mom died. And they kind of helped push me into the eighth. You know, you're living it. The rest of us, let's not focus on the rocks you need to drop that you looked at in your sixth step. Or let's not focus on your imperfections, but to note them in your day. You know, and if you're on your knees and you're asking God to remove the desire for alcohol, and you're asking him to direct your actions and your thinking for the day, and you're doing the best you can, then be okay with it. And it was at that point, it was my brother's group that kind of helped teach that next piece. And I never grew more spiritually that year after my mother died. And it was partly because I could, I knew I wasn't that defiant little brat anymore. And 2 months after my mom died, my father was diagnosed with cancer. And there was no one around. I think I forgot to say that somewhere in here, a couple years had gone by. So I'm now in program. I was almost 5 years sober when my mother died. Not quite, but like 4.5 years sober. And I was newly married with a new baby. And I had thought, you know, I was doing everything right, except that, you know, that I hadn't learned to really love Justine yet. I mean, I thought I had. I had been really working the steps and really, But at that point, I realized that it just keeps going around in a big circle, that I'm powerless over people, places, and things, that my insanity, the thinking, is no longer a drinking problem, a thinking problem, that I have to keep, you know, surrendering myself. And the third step prayer meant something more at the fourth year than it did the first year. Like, all of a sudden, I get it, you know, that I'm supposed to be in action. And I had met my husband in the program, and now my ex-husband, and he was someone that it was actually a fellow who I admired, although he was not a big book person. I was actually attracted to that, thinking, oh, thank God, I won't get, you know, thank God, just normal AA person. Yes and no is that when things happen, and I was in that marriage for many years, and actually after 25 years of marriage, we divorced, partly because of some extenuating circumstances, but partly because what I had learned in my recovery, and I'm very careful not sharing a story that's not mine to tell, is that I had learned to do a daily reprieve. I had learned to do a daily inventory, and I had really had to learn to keep the issues on my side of the street. So, going backwards a little bit, my father is now dying of cancer. I'm the only one available. My other six, the five siblings are at different, very apart. Some are away at school. Some are out of the country, and I was able for the first time to be that daughter that I believe God intended me to be. And I had enough recovery behind me that I was a good listener. I was no longer the one that had to do all the talking. And that year of him with cancer, I got to hear what it must have felt like being in World War II and a decorated Marine, but he was feeling the guilt of some of the things that happened over in Japan. And I lent him my God. I said, Dad, it worked for me. Someone gave me their God while I was trying to figure out mine. So mine is very loving and forgiving. And we had the most incredible few months before cancer took him. And I attribute that to God. Even though it was sad and it was hard to watch someone disappear in front of you, really. And my strength surprised me. And I've heard, you know, hear it in the hall, that God can do for you what you cannot do for yourself. And that daughter that I was and had become, I felt it. I didn't feel it when my mom died, and it was only a year before. But now I had gathered strength from people from the program, and I was given back in a way that, you know, that a daughter would do for a father. And I went on to have two more children with my husband, and we raised them and did the soccer mom and the balancing act. And I had worked my first year. My second child was born and it was an easy pregnancy, but he was a really one of those tough babies, and you almost couldn't put him in daycare because nobody really wanted him. You were always getting phone calls. So I left work, and it was having those two children, and I focused on being a mom. And I'm very grateful for those years because down the road, I would come back and be able to say to people, I did the very best I could. Preston, my second child, was in the program. He came in at 15, and it was because Mini-Me had arrived, and he was blacking out and getting in fights right away. And on his 18th birthday, he celebrated it sober, and two weeks later, he died in a car accident with the abuse of alcohol. And in between there, his little sister was born, Grace, and she was named, that was my middle name, and I never realized that the meaning was an unmerited gift from God. I don't know if it's all right. She's a doll, as a matter of fact. She's up in Massachusetts now, starting her third year of college, and I called her today, and she goes, Mom, I got ants in my pants. And I'm like, what? And she literally, you know, was out doing gardening, and she's just the life of, you know, she brings laughter when we needed laughter. And she was my reason to go on. And the reason I ended up divorcing her dad was that although we were both in the program, drinking and taking any kind of drugs is not an option for me. And the doctors will give any prescription that anybody wants, and Jeff chose to go that route. And it was very heart-wrenching to know that even though in our marriage we constantly struggled because we were both from dysfunctional homes and both emotionally unavailable to each other, but were great parents. And now when Preston died, he literally had a heart attack the night of in the hospital, and then had his ticket. You know, the doctors, you know, you can play that sympathy, and I had enough recovery to know instinctively that is not an option for me. And I had friends who were like, you know, can we get you anything? And I'm like, no, I'm sorry, I gotta go, you know. And I am so grateful that at that point in my sobriety I had so many people who just knew to come, knew to be my strength, and they were there for Jeff. It's just that I think people, we mourn differently, we have different stories, and we interpret what's different. And I couldn't have been more grateful for my foundation, and I have to attribute it to the Big Book, because people didn't give me any wiggle room, and they made it very clear that I had one problem, and that was alcohol. And for me, and for this alcoholic, it also meant that I could not have any mind-altering drugs under any circumstances, and I knew that instinctively. And so we went through the next few years. And I think my role kicked in as, again, the fixer. You know, Grace was only 12. Harry, my oldest boy, the boys were only 14 months apart. And he had just lost his best friend. And although Harry was not a drinker, his role as a brother was that love and protect his brother at all costs. And he really never understood, like when Preston started drinking, why doesn't he just stop? You know, so you saw that pain when Harry was 16 and Preston was 15 and he was supposed to play in a golf tournament. Instead, he's in the hospital getting a cast and a black eye because he got in a fight and doesn't remember it. And Harry's like, why does he do that? So that whole role of going to the principal and trying to get them out of trouble, and Preston, that's probably not a good idea, you know, and role as a mother to trying to get him to Al-Anon and say, you know, you didn't cause it, you can't fix it. But when Harry was got the word his brother died, it was a devastating family event. And for a minute there, I thought I was going to lose him too. You know, he was just incapable and in shock. And again, I have to say that it was the love of AA, people who knew him as a little boy growing up, you know, and they just came around him. They didn't, kind of like that first person that I ran into, they didn't over-smother or try to fix. They just were there for listening. And the bottom line is that when he was ready to talk, there was someone there to listen. And you know, he's now 28. He has a career in Boston. He's a, you know, a sales. He's in sales, and he does very well. And you know, I don't know if he'll have a problem with alcohol. There are certain things that I see as a mother, and I they weren't as obvious as Preston. They didn't hit him as young as my first. But you can see, I leave the door open. One day he asked me, he was down in D.C. for a wedding not too long ago, and he said, Mom, how, because now he's 28, and he knows I came in the program at 22. And he said, Mom, how did you know? And I said, I simply, Harry, do all your friends drink and look at your budget? Don't answer me. Don't even tell me that. But all my friends drank like I did, or they weren't my friends, and all my money went to alcohol and drugs. I didn't accumulate anything. I was young. But at your age, that's probably a good start. And I know where to find that line, if when you honestly want to. But he hasn't asked that yet. And I'm careful because I think I was quick on the gun with Preston. I mean, the first time that child drank, he blacked out. And I'm thinking, there's me. First time he drank, you know, he got that defiant, like it's the cop's fault. You know, and I was blaming God and the police, and didn't anyone know it? And yet, nothing really ever happened to me. I didn't really have any problems. And I'm watching this this kid and watching myself in action. And at that point, at his funeral, and I say this very lovingly, is that I got to see the 12th step in action in all our affairs. His funeral had 1,400 people come through it, from bus drivers to, you know, teachers to people I worked for, and just droves and droves and droves of people, including the police officers, because I had done a lot of DARE work. And I'd done prison ministry. And they're looking, and some of them are crying, like, why this kid? He grew up, but why not? What a better example than to say that we cannot, there's a few empty chairs here. We have no control over who gets those chairs. And when you love someone so much and they drink anyway, then it's one of life's, you know, that they, we don't all get it. And I think when we read, you know, the pole vaulting into the fourth dimension, I get it. There was no reason that I shouldn't have died in that alley. You know, I have no idea why I didn't. I drank, you know, I didn't expect to live to see 25, much less 52. You know, I celebrated my 30th anniversary this year, and it really was sadder to see, you know, the fact that I'm really getting old, but I, it's like I won't tell myself that. I still do cartwheels and still do you know, I don't let myself be caught up in that, the joy of living. You know, I've been given so many gifts. When you talk about, I have no idea if I'm over or not, but I'm going to do the Virginia chapter. And the Virginia chapter was after Preston's death, some just heart-wrenching issues. Jeff retired. It had to do with the big bank, you know, a big and greed. And it was one of the big banks that went down. And then it just snowballed. And I came and put my application in with someone I coincidentally ran into after 30 years who, you know, she ran a position down here in Warrington. So she said, you know, send your application. And I get a position, and I go to a meeting, and I say to people, I got a job offer. And they're like, why do you look so glum? And I'm like, it's in Virginia. And they're like, I know someone in Warrington. I'm like, oh, my God, God, that is not funny. That is, like, not funny. And so, of course, I had to come for the interview. And, you know, you felt God in my life. And when I physically got here, I had realized that the paperwork that we had been stalling for many, many years, even before Preston's death, was to finish up and to end the marriage in a loving way and talk about living the program and all your affairs is working through mediation and working through the best situation for everyone. And do you want to be right or do you want to be happy? You know, and when you and I can say this very truthfully, I could call up my ex-husband right now and be, you know, have a great conversation. When I arrived here, usually I have someone with me. The Madison meeting actually has a big part of my Virginia story because when I first arrived in Warrington, I'm looking for a big book meeting. There's one at night. It's at 8:30 at night. And that's when I'm feeling my age because I'm like, really? You know, where I was from, there were more frequent. And it isn't that it's better or not. I just got all excited when I opened up the book and saw how many meetings were in Warrington. And then for me, what worked for me was a speaker meeting, a step meeting, and a big book meeting. And it was great to go to discussion meetings, and discussion meetings are great. But for me, I can get off track, and I need the literature to wheel me in. And although I have read, you know, steps in the step book many, many times, I read things in the literature, and different things mean different. They stand out, and they change, and I can feel it in my heart. And it was part of our reading today, where we're touched in the heart, and those tears will trigger just out of gratitude. And I, you know, when I came here, I was a single 21-year-old brat, you know, and I went through that whole life process, married, children, death. If you stay sober and you keep coming to meetings, then life happens. You know, people get married, they die, they, you know, families get closer and you know, extensions of and children have issues and there's life that happens, and I was so grateful I have the tools. And I arrived in Warrington. I was really looking to be that newcomer again, the 90 meetings in 90 days, and throw myself in. And I learned that if you're on the outside of a pack, you could get picked off. And, you know, I arrived here and I had some sobriety. I mean, I knew what to do. And I had people on the other end just, you know, making me accountable. And I'm like, oh, yes, I went to a meeting. Yes, I have a sponsor. Yes, I'm giving back. Yes, I have a service position. You know, and I wasn't a newcomer by years, but I'm only sober today. And people knew that it was a red flag. You change your job, you're going through a tough time. You need to be accountable. You know, did you establish your program? And I really did do that. Having said that, I met a wonderful person who coincidentally moved the same week I did from Alaska instead of Massachusetts. And coincidentally, their sponsor had told them to get to a big book meeting and to a step meeting. And what I found out is that there was a lot of fun that went on. We were part of a hiking group, and we did a lot of sober hikes. And I told him one day that, yep, I'll meet you after a hike at your house. I didn't know that there was no cell phone service in Virginia when you hit the mountains. So I didn't know that, you know, White Oak Canyon can be an 8-hour godforsaken hike. I thought it was like, you know, a 2-hour. So here, no call, no show, no phone. Thought you were going to be here after your hike. I arrive at Rick's house, like panting, like, I didn't know there's no cell, and I can't walk another inch. And he's like, why don't I get you in the car? We'll drive out to Madison. It's a speaker meeting. And, you know, and our friendship started driving out to Madison because of the ride out here, and because it was familiar that we could sit in the back of the room. Long story short, Rick and I got engaged about three weeks ago, and then he really wanted to be here, but had to work, and because we both had this warmth about this particular meeting, and you know, I, as I said, came from Warrington. That's quite a hike, so it's not something we could do often, and but there's something that felt like home. You know, you're used to your familiarity. The people's faces have changed, but the message is there. And the format is here. And I had a really great story when, you know, I first arrived here. I really work at talking slower. Up in the north, we just talk so fast. And we think it's you guys who have problems because you don't listen fast enough. So I really had to look at that. You know, you can see that was one of those 10 steps. You know, is it them? That whole, you know, if you're finger pointing, what's in the mirror? So I really, really work at that. And so learning to do things differently, you know, that there's some beautiful things that Virginia does that that have become my own. And tonight I started to bring out one of the girls I sponsored with, and it didn't work out, and I didn't have that need to go fix her. I'm like, good. You do what you need to do, and I need to come out because it's a commitment. And I'm available, and I will do anything for someone who's willing to work the steps. But you can't kid a kidder, you know. And until I was ready, I wasn't ready. And I can want in my head to be sober, but it took clocking a lot of hours in the chair with a cork in my mouth, you know, to shut up and listen and begin opportunities to work them in your life. So I've had the most incredible journey here in Virginia. My original interview here was to work remotely, but I had the option to go back to Massachusetts. And that was one of the toughest things that I did, was to choose to stay here. And the reason I did is there was a difference. I really had to soul search and ask both people from home and here. And then I started calling this home, and it's because the geographical cure. I was one that used to run, you know, as a kid. So I had to really talk it out with people. And they talk about that. You know, if you don't know, God works through people. And there was a difference between a fresh start and a geographical cure. And I started not having to be my old story. And my old story has a lot of sadness to it. And having a lot of family members, I was one of six. And, you know, one would assume that everyone got sober and stayed sober, and that is not the case. You know, some have tried and didn't get sober. I have one brother who is an acupuncturist And joke in our family is that he does a little Chinese medicine, and that works for him. And if he has a sobriety date, that's his date. And he uses that. I have a sister who's heart-wrenching. It's my reminder of why I don't drink, is that I don't know how she still lives. She has a wonderful husband who's a great enabler, and I watch my niece daily become the mother. You know, and it's very hard to watch that, you know, and I really have to be that example, not be the thumper. I know where the answers are for me, but I don't know what the answers are for her. There's a possibility that her role on this planet is not to get sober, but it is so hard for me to watch that I really have to set boundaries. I have a sister who is in Maryland who's got 31 years of sobriety, and she struggles with some bipolar, and I had to be really careful because that happened somewhere in her sobriety where she needed to seek some outside help, and I had to be really careful not to be judgmental. I am not a doctor. I am not a lawyer, and in my own family, there's a unique and circumstances that I found out that being Preston's mother, that I was not the best carrier of the AA message when it comes to family. You know, I would love that. I would love to save them all. They're the ones that mean the most to me, but I can't. I really can't. That's why I'm very particularly careful with my oldest boy, Harry, and Grace, is that they know where I am. They know what I do. And I was given a second chance, and that's the chair I hold on to. And I'm willing to, you know, extend my hand to the newcomer. And if anyone asks me to sponsor them, I say the same thing. You know, yep, I'll walk you through the steps. You know, let me know how that, you know, what you want to do. What's your definition of recovery? You know, I happen to want I want the whole package. I want the whole package. And, you know, the other day, it's been raining in Virginia. Even I know that this is not usually the screen, because even I'm cutting lawn, and I'm like, really? But Rick had to work. He's been mandated for FAA, and it had to do with the furlough. And he loves cutting his lawn. That's his meditation time. I got hold of the keys to the Kubota, and I don't do it in straight lines. I'm doing all these loopies and writing my name. And so he comes in, he goes, all right, turn over the keys. I'm like, I'm driving sober, you know, all around the yard, you know. So to me, you know, life is good. You know, I work in a setting, there's a lot of alcohol. People, you know, they 5 o'clock somewhere, and they hit those cocktails, and there's a lot of pressure, and that's not an option for me, you know, and I know that. So I have, I get on my knees in the morning, and I ask a power greater than myself to remove me from alcohol. I get, I ask for my thinking and my actions to be directed by him, and that someone put in my path that either I'm supposed to share or learn from, and sometimes I'm confused, so I pause and invite God in. And that Massachusetts wanting to talk, sometimes I just have to listen. And that took practice to do that. And I think that's it. You know, I was asked to come out. I have no idea how long I talked, but that's my story. And there it is. Thank you.